This is 2023-0964 Marysville Exempted Village Schools Board of Education versus the Union County Board of Revision. On behalf of the appellant, Mr. Shimchek?
Smishak, Your Honor.
Smishak.
Thank you.
I apologize.
No. Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court, I am Stephen Smishak, representing the appellant, the residents at Cooks Point LLC. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. Today, I wish to focus on 4 points that demonstrate that the Court of Appeals mistakenly delayed the application of the appeal prohibition contained in Revised Code Section 5717.01, which for brevity I'll refer to as .01. Those 4 points are: the plain language of the statute controls; 2, the right of appeal is created by a separate and distinct statute from the statute controlling the filing of a BOR complaint; 3, the statutory prohibition on filing an appeal is a remedial change that prospectively applies to BOR decisions issued on or after the July 21, 2022 effective date of House Bill 126; and 4, the General Assembly can apply a statute to past transactions of any government entity without making that statute retroactive. By way of background, the change in 01 that now limits complaints by subdivisions that do not own or lease the subject property stems from the fact that Ohio is only one of 3 states that permit boards of education to file increased complaints on real property matters. In recent years, the General Assembly has concluded that BOE law firms have become increasingly predatory in their filings, often given carte blanche by boards of education to file on whatever they wish. The 200-plus property owners waiting on a resolution of the issue here today are but a subgroup of the cases filed by BOEs for tax year 2021, but exemplify a larger concern. The General Assembly's action in House Bill 126 to limit appeals was based on its desire to address these perceived abuses and put Ohio more in line with the majority of states. Now, shifting to point one, the phrase "a subdivision that files" must be read in the context of the statute. The VTA found in its North Ridgeville decision, the decision that underlies the dismissal in this matter, that .01 applied to any appeal related to a BOR decision issued on or after the effective date of House Bill 126, quote, based on the straightforward application of an unambiguous law. Simply put, a subdivision that files does not define the effective date of the prohibition. It is not operative language. Rather, it defines the class of persons who are subject to the new appeal prohibition. The plain reading of .01 applies to A, a government subdivision; B, that files a complaint or countercomplaint, that is, they are a party to the BOR proceeding and the BOR decision; and C, who do not own the property at issue. Marysville, in this case, fully satisfied all of those conditions and was therefore barred from filing its appeal. The appellate court mistakenly thought that the filing of a Board of Revision complaint created the point in time to first apply the appeal prohibition. It did so by overemphasizing a single word, files. The court implicitly assumed that the verb tense relates the time of filing to the effective date of House Bill 126, and to do so focuses on legislative intent based on this single word. But this interpretation adds requirements that are not written within the statute itself. There is nothing in the statute, nothing in the uncodified language of House Bill 126, nothing anywhere to express an intent by the General Assembly that the appeal prohibition in the except clause should not immediately apply upon the effective date of the bill.
So filing, you're saying it only applies to the appeal and not the complaint?
That is correct, Your Honor. By linking the filing of the underlying complaint to the right to appeal, What the Court of Appeals essentially did was say that your appeal rights are defined the moment you file your complaint with a BOR. It ignored the fact that we're dealing with two separate statutes, one dealing with the filing of the complaint, one dealing with an appeal, and your appeal rights do not accrue until the BOR decision is issued.
So, but the statute says specifically, except that a subdivision that files an original complaint under 5715.19 is indicative, that's the exact language. How do we tie that to the appeal when the statute says files an original complaint?
That statutory language, the subdivision that files, simply defines the standing of who may file an appeal at the BTA. It says, look, if you are a subdivision that files a complaint or counter-complaint, that is, you are a party to the BOR decision, then you are precluded from filing an appeal to the BTA unless you own the property.
Isn't that kind of a strange way to write the statute if that's what the legislature meant? I mean, you know, it doesn't say that has filed. Mm-hmm. If it said has filed, then you know you would have a strong argument. But files seems a little odd way to say that. And shouldn't we give, absent any other textual clues in the statute about what the legislature intended, shouldn't we give that some significance?
Two things. One, by the time you reach the point of filing an appeal, the filing of a complaint is always in the past tense. So when you look
right.
at the term,
that's the point.
The filing
of the complaint is always in the past tense. But here, what the legislature said is that files, which would seem under the ordinary understanding, is that this starts the effectiveness of this is based on the filing of something, not. Not what happened in the past.
Again, I believe what we're doing is we're really defining a class of persons to whom this applies. It is not an attempt to link the filing of an appeal, a later accrued right, to the filing of a complaint that has already occurred. I think, too, that had the General Assembly intended there to be a link, it certainly knows and could have used much better language. It could have included in 5717.
Doesn't that argument cut both ways? I mean, if it clearly could have used language to make clear that it was going to apply to all past complaints, but it didn't.
It didn't need to, because under Ohio general law, whenever a change in a remedial statute takes place by the General Assembly, it applies to any and all cases that are pending at the lower tribunal. This court said so in Slaughter, as well as other cases. So it didn't need to specify that it would apply to all prior cases or pending cases. That is a matter of established Ohio law.
But I think, aren't you talking about what law you use or what standard of review that you use? As far as the standing of a party to continue with their litigation when a statute hits mid-litigation, I'm not sure that what you're saying applies in that situation, because otherwise I don't think we'd be here.
Again, I think that we're dealing with a situation where we are talking about a descriptive phrase. We're talking about who has standing to file. And all it does is say that a person who files complaints is among that class of persons to whom the prohibition applies.
So the statute's pretty specific and says original complaint.
Mm-hmm.
If the subdivision came in as a third party,
Subdivision under the BOR complaint statute could not come in as a third party. They are expressly defined as a subdivision and must file either a complaint or original complaint. A third party complainant is one who is not a subdivision. Generally, we're talking about people who own property in the county.
Like the Cooks.
Who may file.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And certainly, at least 01 as it stands today, although there is some pending legislation to change that, a third-party appellant could appeal to the BTA if not satisfied with the BOR decision. But in this particular case, we're dealing with a change in a remedial statute that was engaged in by the General Assembly, and such changes should apply immediately upon the effective date of House Bill 126, unless otherwise stated. And again, there is nothing in House Bill 126 that says 01 does not apply immediately. There are provisions in 126 that do say, for instance, certain filing requirements are not to come in until tax year 2022, but this does not apply to 01. I think this goes to what the BTA said in its underlying North Ridgeville decision, which may be helpful. They said the right to appeal to this board is independent of the right to file a complaint or counter-complaint with the Board of Revision. This separation between underlying cause and action and the right to file an appeal is not unique, nor is the circumstance where the changes to an appellate statute affect cases that were pending before the enactment. The BTA went on to summarize that jurisdiction is not conferred on an appeal merely because an underlying cause of action has been validly filed. And this tracks with this court's own decisions that state that the right to appeal is a separate and distinct right from the right to complain, and that no right of appeal accrues until one first receives an adverse judgment from the lower tribunal. This court has also held that the General Assembly is free to change a remedial right in a remedial statute at any time, and that such amendments apply to all pending proceedings. And I see I've moved my time. Unless there are any questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On behalf of Appalese, Ms. Goring. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much. May it please the court, I'm Kelly Gorey of Rich and Gillis Law Group on behalf of Appellee Marysville Exempted Village School District. Quickly, I will respond to appellant's 4 points. The first is that the Board of Education and all three courts of appeals who have decided this matter, we're only talking about the third district's decision today, have agreed that the plain language of the statute controls. What happened in North Ridgeville was that the BTA analyzed the uncodified, what I've called the effective date clause. So in other words, since section 3 in the statute omitted any reference to 57-1701, the BTA simply concluded that language itself was unambiguous. I don't disagree with that, but its entire analysis stopped there. The BTA never actually got to what does the words of repealed and replaced 57-1701 say? And that is where the plain language controls. Simply put, there would have been no reason for the legislature to base the operative language of the statute upon the filing of a complaint, unless that's exactly what they meant. So they retained, when they repealed and replaced the statute, they retained, as the 10th District called it, the general rule. So that was the pre-existing language in the statute that authorized boards of education to appeal. It was a board authorized to file complaints, not original complaints and counter-complaints, pursuant to 57-1519. That's the first part of the sentence that remains in the statute today. The second part is the conditional exception, which requires that the prohibition be applied when a subdivision has files, and it was in the present tense, as the third district aptly recognized, an original complaint or a counter-complaint.
Does it make any difference, as far as the statute goes, that Marysville filed a counter-complaint and the statute focuses on an original complaint?
No, and the reason is why. Under former 57-1519 that was in effect when we filed the, I'm going to call it a B complaint, because this court has actually recognized that former 57-1519 doesn't actually use the terms original complaint and counter complaint in reference to a 57-1519A and a 5715-19B complaint. What Marysville filed in this case was a 5715-19B complaint, termed a complaint under the former statute, and our existing statutory right of appeal was protected in the general rule language, the first part of the sentence that the legislature retained in the amendment.
Thank you.
So both complaints and counter-complaints covered, filed prior to the effective date of the statute in the first part of the sentence that the legislature retained. They created a conditional exception based upon the filing, an act in the future, of an original complaint or a counter-complaint. Appellant's interpretation of the statute, just as the BTA did in North Ridgeville, asked you to actually give no meaning to the words that files an original complaint or counter-complaint under that section. Strike that. The BTA gave it no meaning. And then second, after it's talking about the property that's owned or leased, it again says the decision under the original complaint or counter-complaint. So the BTA's interpretation literally struck three-quarters of the words of the statute and gave no meaning to them whatsoever. And that is now what three separate appellate courts have held is legal error based upon the plain and unambiguous language of the statute. And then getting to the second point.
What would happen if the statute didn't say anything?
If the statute didn't create a new conditional exception?
Well, if the statute if the statute simply said that there was no right to appeal
for the school board, we wouldn't be here if it said a subdivision may not appeal.
So you think the default rule is that as your opponent says, is the statute's remedial and that it applies going forward?
No, I'm sorry. The to accept the appellant's position, the words in the statute would have had to have been different.
I'm just trying to establish what you think the default rule is.
So I think the default rule is the original language that was retained by the legislature, board, legislative authority, public official. That was the original language in the statute.
I think you're missing my question. If the statute didn't have these textual clues that you point to, if it simply said that there was no right of a school board to appeal, would that apply to would that apply going forward to all appeals or simply in new actions?
No, I think it would apply only going forward. No, if they had used the correct words, the statute could have been applied retroactively to all pending actions.
Okay, but what I'm asking you is, if there are no words, what's the default rule?
If there were no words and the statute wasn't amended, a Board of Education would still have a right of appeal.
Okay. I don't know if you don't understand my question or you don't want to answer it.
No, I'm sorry. I think if you're asking me, had they used the right words, could it have applied?
No, that's not what I'm asking. What I'm asking you is, if it didn't specify at all whether it was retroactive or prospective, what would the default rule be?
Oh, I think the default rule is prospective pursuant to 1.48. And that's a rule of statutory construction.
Right, but in this case, the appeal itself isn't prospective.
The appeal itself would be prospective, yes. I think that the prohibition could have been effective upon the effective date to existing and pending actions had the words in the statute been different. And I'm sorry, that would be my answer to the question. Had the legislature used different words, it could have been effective immediately. Does that answer your question? I do want to answer your question.
Really, but you can just move on.
Getting into the second point, yes, a right to appeal is different, is contained in a different statute than the right to file a complaint. But in this case, the legislature specifically enacted operative language of the statute that is conditioned upon the filing of an original complaint or new complaint, which terms are indisputably not effective until tax year 2022 under amended 5715-19. Excuse me. Regarding remedial versus substantive, we don't get there. First, the court has to find that the language of the statute applies retroactively to all pending actions as of the date of the amendment. That's what the Third District held we don't have here. We don't have, based upon the plain language of the statute, an intent for the legislature to apply this appeal prohibition to any existing complaints filed prior to the effective date of the statute. And the reason we know that is because the legislature retained the existing appellate right in the new version of the statute for all complaints filed pursuant to former 5715-19 that were deemed complaints, not original complaints or counter-complaints. So therefore, the only way to construe the plain language of the statute in proper context, interpreting not only the retained provision, but also the new provision, is the legislature must have chosen that the words to use so that they had different meanings. And that's the crux of the 10th District's decision, and the 5th District also accepts that reasoning as well. But Marysville is not arguing that this statute is a prohibited, unconstitutional, retroactive law. We don't need to get there. It's irrelevant. First, the court would have to find that the statute itself is expressly made retroactive, and under 1.48, a statute has to be presumed to be prospective unless expressly made retroactive. The Third District found we didn't get there. It doesn't matter if a statute is remedial or substantive until it's first found that it is retroactive. And Marysville, as a governmental entity, has a right to ask the court to follow the court's own rules and codified rules of statutory construction. That's all we were asking the Third District to do, was review and read the actual words of the statute as written by the General Assembly and apply those words. Again, the BTA's decision can only be supported by giving no meaning to three quarters of the words that the legislature actually used in the amended statute. So it's our position that all three courts of appeals in this case have gotten it right. The Third District focused mainly on the use, present tense use of the word files. We believe that was correct. The 10th District and the 5th District went even farther, indicating that the legislature's explicit use of new statutory definitions, which had no meaning until 5715-19 was amended by House Bill 126, were in effect. So looking at the entire sentence as its entirety, we had a statutory right to appeal. That was the general appellate language that was retained, and Marysville had not yet fulfilled the exception language by filing an original complaint or a counter complaint under amended 5715-19. Thank you. If anyone has any further questions, I think I'm done.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Schmidt, you have 3 minutes and 53 seconds.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I appreciate it. Very quickly, in response to Marysville's comments, There is nothing in our argument that asks this court to ignore a single word of the statute. Our interpretation is simply based on the plain language that exists there. Point 01 clearly defines both a class and the right to appeal, but these do not take effect, or that is, 01 has not become activated until the BOR decision is issued. At that time, 01 says clearly that a subdivision cannot file an appeal and defines, and the use of the word files is simply a way of defining that class. Had the General Assembly intended to delay the application of point 01, it certainly could have done so in the uncodified language of House Bill 126. It did not. Instead, it made point 01 effective on July 21, 2022, with the rest of the statute.
So you're saying that it's prospective, that the prospective application is applied based on the issuance of the decision or the judgment?
That is correct. At the point the BOR issues its decision is when your appeal rights accrue under the law.
So it's kind of like if a statute comes along and in a criminal case where you have conviction and you have sentence, and the statute takes effect in between the date of the conviction and the date of the sentence, then a court has to figure out which it applies to.
In a way, yes, although this court has treated language prospective retroactive activity in criminal cases differently than it does in civil matters. But it has specifically addressed issues where a change in the remedy has been implemented while a civil matter is pending below, and has said that those changes apply to any pending matter, so that once the decision of the BOR took place, you're subject to 5701 as it existed as of the date of the decision.
Except in this case, it's not a change in the type of remedy. It's either you get a remedy or you don't.
That is correct, but the General Assembly, and remember that the right to appeal is purely statutory here, as is the right to complain. The General Assembly could have eliminated a right to appeal altogether for everybody, could have said you go to the BOR and that's it, but it chose a different route. It chose simply to modify who can and who cannot appeal to the BTA.
Thank you.
I also want to quickly address the reliance on original complaint and counter complaint. I've done research all the way back to 1972, and this court, as well as the BTA, BOR, and even the complaint forms, always refer to original complaint and counter complaint to differentiate between the initial complaint filed under 19A and the counter complaint filed under 19B. The codification that we're talking about is simply adopting those common usages. There are no changes. And so we would say that it makes no sense to say that somehow simply recognizing what a common usage is somehow stops one right and creates another right. In conclusion, the appellate court's decision to link the filing of a BOR complaint to a later vested right to appeal is not consistent with the language of the statute or the right of the General Assembly to make an immediate change to the remedial right of appeal. The phrase, a subdivision that files, defines a class to which the filing prohibition applies. It does not delay the application of the prohibition based on when the underlying complaint is filed. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a decision from the court. Marshall, please recess the court.
All rise.